This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents White Teeth by Zadie Smith. Read for you by Lenny Henry, Pippa Bennett Warner, Ray Panthaki, and Sagar Arya.
Archie, 1974-1945. Every little trifle, for some reason, does seem incalculably important today. And when you say of a thing that nothing hangs on it, it sounds like blasphemy. There's never any knowing, how am I to put it? Which of our actions, which of our idlenesses, won't have things hanging on it forever? Where Angels Fear to Tread, E. M. Forster. 1. The Peculiar Second Marriage of Archie Jones. Early in the morning, late in the century, Cricklewood Broadway. At 06:27 hours on 1st of January 1975, Alfred Archibald Jones was dressed in corduroy and sat in a fume-filled Cavalier Musketeer estate, face down on the steering wheel, hoping the judgment would not be too heavy upon him. He lay forward in a prostrate cross, jaws slack, arms splayed either side like some fallen angel. Scrunched up in each fist, he held his army service medals, left, and his marriage license, right, for he had decided to take his mistakes with him. A little green light flashed in his eye, signaling a right turn he had resolved never to make. He was resigned to it. He was prepared for it. He had flipped a coin and stood staunchly by its conclusions. This was a decided upon suicide. In fact, it was a New Year's resolution. But even as his breathing became spasmodic and his lights dimmed, Archie was aware that Cricklewood Broadway would seem a strange choice. Strange to the first person to notice his slumped figure through the windscreen. Strange to the policeman who would file the report. To the local journalist called upon to write 50 words. To the next of kin who would read them. Squeezed between an almighty concrete cinema complex at one end and a giant intersection at the other, Cricklewood was no kind of place. It was not a place a man came to die. It was a place a man came in order to go other places via the A41. But Archie Jones didn't want to die in some pleasant, distant woodland or on a cliff edge fringed with delicate heather. The way Archie saw it, country people should die in the country and city people should die in the city. Only proper. In death, as he was in life, and all that. It made sense that Archibald should die on this nasty urban street where he'd ended up. Living alone at the age of 47 in a one-bedroom flat above a deserted chip shop. He wasn't the type to make elaborate plans, suicide notes and funeral instructions. He wasn't the type for anything fancy. All he asked for was a bit of silence, a bit of shush, so he could concentrate. He wanted it to be perfectly quiet and still, like the inside of an empty confessional box or the moment in the brain between thought and speech. He wanted to do it before the shops opened. Overhead, a gang of the local flying vermin took off from some unseen perch, swooped, and seemed to be zeroing in on Archie's car roof, only to perform, at the last moment, an impressive U-turn, moving as one with the elegance of a curveball and landing on the Hussein Ishmael, a celebrated halal butcher's. Archie was too far gone to make a big noise about it. But he watched them with a warm internal smile as they deposited their load, streaking white walls purple. He watched them stretch their peering bird heads over the Hussein Ishmael gutter. He watched them watch the slow and steady draining of blood from the dead things, chickens, cows, sheep, hanging on their hooks like coats around the shop. The unlucky. These pigeons had an instinct for the unlucky, and so they passed Archie by. For, though he did not know it, and despite the Hoover tube that lay on the passenger seat, pumping from the exhaust pipe into his lungs, luck was with him that morning. The thinnest covering of luck was on him like fresh dew. Whilst he slipped in and out of consciousness, the position of the planets, the music of the spheres, the flap of a tiger moth's diaphanous wings in Central Africa, and a whole bunch of other stuff that makes shit happen, had decided it was second chance time for Archie. Somewhere, somehow, by somebody, it had been decided that he would live. The Hussein Ishmael was owned by Mo Hussein Ishmael, a great bull of a man with hair that rose and fell in a quiff, then a ducktail. Mo believed that with pigeons, you have to get to the root of the problem. Not the excretions, but the pigeon itself. The shit is not the shit. This was Mo's mantra. The pigeon is the shit. So the morning of Archie's almost death began as every morning in the Hussein Ishmael, with Mo resting his huge belly on the windowsill, leaning out and swinging a meat cleaver in an attempt to halt the flow of dribbling purple. Get out of it! Get away, you shit-making bastards! Yes! Six! It was cricket, basically. The Englishman's game, adapted by the immigrant, and six was the most pigeons you could get at one swipe. Barin! Said Mo, calling down to the street, holding the bloodied cleaver up in triumph. You're into bat, my boy! Ready? Below him on the pavement stood Varin, a massively overweight Hindu boy on misjudged work experience from the school round the corner, looking up like a big dejected blob underneath Mo's question mark. It was Varin's job to struggle up a ladder and gather spliced bits of pigeon into a small quicksave carrier bag, tie the bag up, and dispose of it in the bins at the other end of the street.
Come on, Mr. Fatty Man,
yelled one of Mo's kitchen staff, poking Varin up the arse with a broom as punctuation for each word.
Get your fat Ganesh Hindu backside up there, elephant boy, and bring some of that mashed pigeon stuff with you.
Mo wiped the sweat off his forehead, snorted, and looked out over Cricklewood, surveying the discarded armchairs and strips of carpet, outdoor lounges for local drunks, the slot machine emporiums, the greasy spoons and the minicabs, all covered in shit. One day, so Mo believed, Cricklewood and its residents would have cause to thank him for his daily massacre. One day no man, woman or child in the Broadway would ever again have to mix one part detergent to four parts vinegar to clean up the crap that falls on the world. The shit is not the shit, he repeated solemnly. The pigeon is the shit. Mo was the only man in the community who truly understood. He was feeling really very zen about this, very goodwill to all men, until he spotted Archie's car.
Arshad!
A shifty-looking skinny guy with a handlebar moustache, dressed in four different shades of brown, came out of the shop, with blood on his palms.
Arshad?
Mo barely restrained himself, stabbed his finger in the direction of the car. My boy, I'm going to ask you just once. Yes, Abba, said Arshad, shifting from foot to foot.
What the hell is this? What is this doing here? I got delivery at 6:30. I got 15 dead bovines turning up here at 6:30. I got to get it in the back. That's my job, you see. There's meat coming.
So I am perplexed. Mo affected a look of innocent confusion, because I thought this was clearly marked delivery area. He pointed to an aging wooden crate which bore the legend, No parkings of any vehicle on any days.
Well?
I don't know, Abba.
You're my son, Arshad. I don't employ you not to know. I employ him not to know.
He reached out of the window and slapped Varin, who was negotiating the perilous gutter like a tightrope walker, giving him a thorough kosh to the back of his head and almost knocking the boy off his perch.
I employ you to know things, to compute information, to bring into the light the great darkness of the Creator's unexplainable universe.
Abba?
Find out what it's doing there and get rid of it.
Mo disappeared from the window. A minute later, Arshad returned with the explanation. Abba? Mo's head sprang back through the window like a malicious cuckoo from a Swiss clock. He's gassing himself, Abba.
What?
Arshad shrugged. I shouted through the car window and told the guy to move on, and he says, I'm gassing myself, leave me alone. Like that.
No one gasses himself on my property, Mo snapped as he marched downstairs. We are not licensed.
Once in the street, Mo advanced upon Archie's car, pulled out the towels that were sealing the gap in the driver's window, and pushed it down 5 inches with brute, bullish force.
Do you hear that, mister? We're not licensed for suicides around here. This place halal, kosher, understand? If you're going to die around here, my friend, I'm afraid you've got to be thoroughly bled first.
Archie dragged his head off the steering wheel, and in the moment between focusing on the sweaty bulk of a brown-skinned Elvis and realizing that life was still his, he had a kind of epiphany. It occurred to him that for the first time since his birth, life had said yes to Archie Jones, not simply an okay or you might as well carry on since you've started, but a resounding affirmative. Life wanted Archie. She had jealously grabbed him from the jaws of death back to her bosom. Although he was not one of her better specimens, life wanted Archie, and Archie, much to his own surprise, wanted life. Frantically, he wound down both his windows and gasped for oxygen from the very depths of his lungs. In between gulps, he thanked Mo profusely, tears streaming down his cheeks, his hands clinging on to Mo's apron.
All right, said the butcher, freeing himself from Archie's fingers and brushing himself clean. Move along now. I've got meat coming in. I'm in the business of bleeding, not counseling. You want Lonely Street. This Cricklewood Lane.
Archie, still choking on thank yous, reversed, pulled out from the curb, and turned right. Archie Jones attempted suicide because his wife, Ophelia, a violet-eyed Italian with a faint moustache, had recently divorced him, but he had not spent New Year's morning gagging on the tube of a vacuum cleaner because he loved her. It was rather because he had lived with her for so long and had not loved her. Archie's marriage felt like buying a pair of shoes, taking them home, and finding they don't fit. For the sake of appearances, he put up with them, and then, all of a sudden, and after 30 years, the shoes picked themselves up and walked out of the house. She left. 30 years. As far as he remembered, just like everybody else, they began well. The first spring of 1946, he'd stumbled out of the darkness of war and into a Florentine coffee house, where he was served by a waitress truly like the sun, Ophelia Diagilo, dressed all in yellow, spreading warmth and the promise of sex as she passed him a frothy cappuccino. They walked into it blinkered as horses. She was not to know that women never stayed as daylight in Archie's life, that somewhere in him he didn't like them, he didn't trust them, and he was able to love them only if they wore halos. No one told Archie that lurking in the Diagilo family tree were two hysteric aunts, an uncle who talked to aubergines, and a cousin who wore his clothes back to front. So they got married and returned to England, where she realized very quickly her mistake. He drove her very quickly mad, and the halo was packed off to the attic to collect dust with the rest of the bric-a-brac and broken kitchen appliances that Archie promised one day to repair. Amongst that bric-a-brac was a Hoover. On Boxing Day morning, 6 days before he parked outside Moe's Halal Butchers, Archie had returned to their semi-detached in Hendon in search of that Hoover. It was his fourth trip to the attic in so many days, ferrying out the odds and ends of a marriage to his new flat, and the Hoover was amongst the very last items he reclaimed. One of the most broken things, most ugly things, the things you demand out of sheer bloody-mindedness because you've lost the house. This is what divorce is, taking things you no longer want from people you no longer love.
So, you again,
said the Spanish home help at the door, Santa Maria or Maria Santa or something.
Mr. Jones, what now? Kitchen sink, see?
Hoover, said Archie grimly, vacuum. She cut her eyes at him and spat on the doormat inches from his shoes.
Welcome, senor.
The place had become a haven for people who hated him. Apart from the home help, he had to contend with Ophelia's extended Italian family, her mental health nurse, the woman from the council, and, of course, Ophelia herself, who was to be found in the kernel of this nuthouse, curled up in a fetal ball on the sofa, making lowing sounds into a bottle of Bailey's. It took him an hour and a quarter just to get through enemy lines, and for what? A perverse Hoover, discarded months earlier, because it was determined to perform the opposite of every vacuum's objective, spewing out dust instead of sucking it in.
Mr. Jones, why do you come here when it makes you so unhappy? Be reasonable. What can you want with it?
The home help was following him up the attic stairs, armed with some kind of cleaning fluid.
It's broken. You don't need this. See? See?
She plugged it into a socket and demonstrated the dead switch. Archie took the plug out and silently wound the cord round the Hoover. If it was broken, it was coming with him. All broken things were coming with him. He was going to fix every damn broken thing in this house, if only to show that he was good for something.
You good for nothing,
Santa, whoever chased him back down the stairs.
Your wife is ill in her head, and this is all you can do?
Archie hugged the Hoover to his chest and took it into the crowded living room, where, under several pairs of reproachful eyes, he got out his toolbox and started work on it. Look at him, said one of the Italian grandmothers, the more glamorous one with the big scarves and fewer moles. He take everything, capisce? He take her mind. He take the blender. He take the old stereo. He take everything except the floorboards. He make you sick. The woman from the council, who even on dry days resembled a long-haired cat soaked to the skin, shook her skinny head in agreement.
It's disgusting. You don't have to tell me. It's disgusting. And naturally, we're the ones left to sort out the mess. It's Maggins here who has to...
Which was overlapped by the nurse. She can't stay here alone, can she? Now he's buggered off, poor woman. She needs a proper home. She needs... I'm here, Archie felt like saying. I'm right here, you know. I'm bloody right here. And it was my blender. But he wasn't one for confrontation, Archie. He listened to them all for another 15 minutes, mute, as he tested the Hoover's suction against pieces of newspaper, until he was overcome by the sensation that life was an enormous rucksack, so impossibly heavy that, even though it meant losing everything, it was infinitely easier to leave all baggage here on the roadside and walk on into the blackness. You don't need the blender, Archie boy. You don't need the Hoover. This stuff's all dead weight. Just lay down the rucksack, Arch, and join the happy campers in the sky. Was that wrong? To Archie, ex-wife and ex-wife's relatives in one ear, spluttering vacuum in the other, it just seemed that the end was unavoidably nigh. Nothing personal to God or whatever. It just felt like the end of the world. And he was going to need more than poor whiskey, novelty crackers, and a paltry box of Quality Street, all the strawberry ones already scoffed, to justify entering another annum. Patiently, he fixed the Hoover and vacuumed the living room with a strange methodical finality, shoving the nozzle into the most difficult corners. Solemnly, he flipped a coin, heads life, tails death, and felt nothing in particular when he found himself staring at the dancing lion. Quietly, he detached the Hoover tube, put it in a suitcase, and left the house for the last time. But dying's no easy trick, and suicide can't be put on a list of things to do in between cleaning the grill pan and leveling the sofa leg with a brick. It is the decision not to do, to undo, a kiss blown at oblivion. No matter what anyone says, suicide takes guts. It's for heroes and martyrs, truly vainglorious men. Archie was none of these. He was a man whose significance in the greater scheme of things could be figured along familiar ratios. Pebble, beach, raindrop, ocean, needle, haystack. So for a few days he ignored the decision of the coin and just drove around with the Hoover tube. At night he looked out through the windscreen into the monstropolis sky and had the old realization of his universal proportions, feeling what it was to be tiny and rootless. He thought about the dent he might make on the world if he disappeared, and it seemed negligible, too small to calculate. He squandered spare minutes wondering whether Hoover had become a generic term for vacuum cleaners or whether it was, as others have argued, just a brand name. And all the time the Hoover tube lay like a great flaccid cock on his back seat, mocking his quiet fear, laughing at his pigeon steps as he approached the executioner, sneering at his impotent indecision. Then, on the 29th of December, he went to see his old friend Samad Mia Iqbal, an unlikely compadre possibly, but still the oldest friend he had, a Bengali Muslim he had fought alongside back when the fighting had to be done, who reminded him of that war that reminded some people of fatty bacon and painted on stockings, but recalled in Archie gunshots and card games and the taste of a sharp foreign alcohol. "Archie, my dear friend," Samad had said in his warm, hearty tones, "you must forget all this wife trouble. Try a new life. That is what you need. Now, enough of all this. I will match your 5 bob and raise you 5. They were sitting in their new haunt, O'Connell's pool house, playing poker with only 3 hands, 2 of Archie's and 1 of Samad's. Samad's right hand being a broken thing, grey-skinned and unmoving, dead in every way bar the blood that ran through it. The place they sat in, where they met each evening for dinner, was half cafe, half gambling den, owned by an Iraqi family,
the many members of which shared a bad skin condition. Look at me. Marrying Alsana has given me this new lease on living, you understand? She opens up for me the new possibilities. She's so young, so vital, like a breath of fresh air. You come to me for advice. Here it is. Don't live this old life. It's a sick life, Archibald. It does you no good. No good whatsoever. Samad had looked at him with a great sympathy, for he felt very tenderly for Archie. Their wartime friendship had been severed by 30 years of separation across continents, but in the spring of 1973, Samad had come to England, a middle-aged man seeking a new life with his 20-year-old new bride, the diminutive, moon-faced Alsana Begum with her shrewd eyes. In a fit of nostalgia, and because it was the only man Samad knew on this little island, Samad had sought Archie out, moved into the same London borough, and slowly but surely a kind of friendship was being rekindled between the two men.
"You play like a faggot," said Samad, laying down the winning queens back to back. He flicked them with the thumb of his left hand in one elegant move, making them fall to the table in a fan shape.
"I'm old," said Archie, throwing his cards in. "I'm old. Who'd have me now?" It was hard enough convincing anybody the first time.
"That is nonsense, Archibald. You have not even met the right one yet. This Ophelia, Archie, she is not the right one. From what you leave me to understand, she is not even for this time."
He referred to Ophelia's madness, which led her to believe, half of the time, that she was the maid of the celebrated 15th-century art lover Cosimo de Medici.
"She is born, she lives simply in the wrong time. This is just not her day, maybe not her millennium. Modern life has caught that woman completely unawares and up the arse. Her mind is gone. Buggered! And you? You have picked up the wrong life in the cloakroom, and you must return it. Besides, she has not blessed you with children.
And life without children, Archie, what is it for?"
"But there are second chances. Oh, yes, there are second chances in life. Believe me, I know. You," he continued, raking in the 10p with the side of his bad hand, "should never have married her."
Bloody hindsight, thought Archie. It's always 2020. Finally, 2 days after this discussion, early on New Year's morning, the pain had reached such a piercing level that Archie was no longer able to cling to Samad's advice. He had decided instead to mortify his own flesh, to take his own life, to free himself from a life path that had taken him down numerous wrong turnings, led him deep into the wilderness, and finally petered out completely, its breadcrumb course gobbled up by the birds. Once the car starts to fill with gas, he had experienced the obligatory flashback of his life to date. It turned out to be a short, unedifying viewing experience, low on entertainment value, the metaphysical equivalent of the Queen's speech. A dull childhood, a bad marriage, a dead-end job, that classic triumvirate. They all flicked by quickly, silently, with little dialogue, feeling pretty much the same as they did the first time round. He was no great believer in destiny, Archie, but on reflection, it did seem that a special effort of predestination had ensured his life had been picked out for him like a company Christmas present, early and the same as everyone else's. There was the war, of course. He had been in the war, only for the last year of it, aged just 17, but it hardly counted. Not frontline, nothing like that. He and Samad, old Sam, Sammy boy. They had a few tales to tell, mind. Archie even had a bit of shrapnel in the leg for anyone who cared to see it, but nobody did. No one wanted to talk about that anymore. It was like a club foot or a disfiguring mole. It was like nose hair. People looked away. If someone said to Archie, "What have you done in life then?" or "What's your biggest memory?" Well, God help him if he mentioned the war. Eyes glazed over, fingers tapped, everybody offered to buy the next round. No one really wanted to know. Summer of 1955, Archie went to Fleet Street with his best winkle pickers on, looking for work as a war correspondent. Poncy-looking bloke with a thin moustache and a thin voice had said, "Any experience, Mr. Jones?" And Archie had explained, all about Samad, all about their Churchill tank. Then this Poncy one had leant over the desk, all smug, all suited, and said, "We would require something other than merely having fought in a war, Mr. Jones. War experience isn't really relevant." And that was it, wasn't it? There was no relevance in the war. Not in 55, even less now in 74.
Nothing he did then mattered now. The skills you learnt were, in the modern parlance, not relevant, not transferable.
Was there anything else, Mr. Jones?
But of course, there bloody wasn't anything else. The British education system having tripped him up with a snigger many years previously. Still, he had a good eye for the look of a thing, for the shape of a thing, and that's how he'd ended up in the job at Morgan Hero, 20 years and counting in a printing firm in the Euston Road, designing the way all kinds of things should be folded. Envelopes, direct mail, brochures, leaflets. Not much of an achievement, maybe, but you'll find things need folds. They need to overlap. Otherwise life will be like a broadsheet, flapping in the wind and down the street so you lose the important sections. Not that Archie had much time for the broadsheets. If they couldn't be bothered to fold them properly, why should he bother to read them? That's what he wanted to know. What else? Well, Archie hadn't always folded paper. Once upon a time, he'd been a track cyclist. What Archie liked about track cycling was the way you went round and round, round and round, giving you chance after chance to get a bit better at it, to make a faster lap, to do it right. Except the thing about Archie was, he never did get any better. 62.8 seconds, which is a pretty good time, world class standard even, but for 3 years he got precisely 62.8 seconds on every single lap. The other cyclists used to take breaks to watch him do it, lean their bikes against the incline and time him with the second hand of their wristwatches. 62.8, every time. That kind of inability to improve is really very rare. That kind of consistency is miraculous, in a way. Archie liked track cycling. He was consistently good at it, and it provided him with the only truly great memory he had. In 1948, Archie Jones had participated in the Olympics in London, sharing 13th place, 62.8 seconds, with a Swedish gynecologist called Horst Ibelgofts. Unfortunately, this fact had been omitted from the Olympic records by a sloppy secretary who returned one morning after a coffee break with something else on her mind and missed his name as she transcribed one list to another piece of paper. Madame Posterity stuck Archie down the arm of the sofa and forgot about him. His only proof that the event had taken place at all were the periodic letters and notes he'd received over the years from Ibelgofts himself. Notes like,
17th May, 1957. Dear Archibald, I enclose a picture of my good wife and I in our garden in front of a rather unpleasant construction site. Though it may not look like Arcadia, it is here that I am building a crude velodrome. Nothing like the one you and I raced in, but sufficient for my needs. It will be on a far smaller scale, but you see, it is for the children we are yet to have. I see them pedaling around it in my dreams and wake up with a glorious smile upon my face. Once it is completed, we insist that you visit us. Who more worthy to christen the track of your earnest competitor? Horst Ibelgofts. And the postcard that lay on the dashboard this very day, the day of his almost death. 28 December 1974. Dear Archibald, I am taking up the harp. A New Year's resolution, if you like. Late in the day, I realize, but you're never too old to teach the old dog in you new tricks, don't you feel? I tell you, it's a heavy instrument to lay against your shoulder, but the sound of it is quite angelic, and my wife thinks me quite sensitive because of it, which is more than she could say for my old cycling obsession. But then, cycling was only ever understood by old boys like you, Archie, and of course the author of this little note, your old contender, Horst Ibelgofts. He had not met Horst since the race, but he remembered him affectionately, as an enormous man with strawberry blonde hair, orange freckles, and misaligned nostrils, who dressed like an international playboy and seemed too large for his bike. After the race, Horst had got Archie horribly drunk and procured 2 Soho whores who seemed to know Horst well.
I make many business trips to your fair capital, Archibald, Horst had explained.
The last Archie had ever seen of Horst was an unwanted glimpse of his humongous pink arse, bobbing up and down in the adjoining room of an Olympic chalet. The next morning, waiting at the front desk, was the first letter of his large correspondence.
Dear Archibald, in an oasis of work and competition, women are truly sweet and easy refreshment, don't you agree? I am afraid I had to leave early to catch the necessary plane. But I compel you, Archie, don't be a stranger.
I think of us now as two men as close as our finish. I tell you, whoever said 13th was unlucky was a bigger fool than your friend, Horst Ebelgaufts. P.S. Please make sure that Daria and Melanie get home fine and well. Daria was his one. Terribly skinny, ribs like lobster cages and no chest to speak of, but she was a lovely sort, kind, soft with her kisses, and with double-jointed wrists she liked to show off in a pair of long silk gloves. Set you back 4 clothing coupons at least. I like you, Archie remembered saying helplessly, as she replaced the gloves and put on her stockings. She turned, smiled, and though she was a professional, he got the feeling she liked him too. Maybe he should have left with her right then, run to the hills. But at the time it seemed impossible, too involved, what with a young wife with one in the oven, an hysterical fictional pregnancy as it turned out, a big bump full of hot air, what with his dodgy leg, what with the lack of hills. Strangely, Daria was the final pulse of thought that passed through Archie just before he blacked out. It was the thought of a whore he met once 20 years ago. It was Daria and her smile which made him cover Moe's apron with tears of joy as the butcher saved his life. He had seen her in his mind, a beautiful woman in a doorway with a come-hither look, and realized he regretted not coming hither. If there was any chance of her ever seeing a look like that again, then he wanted the second chance. He wanted the extra time. Not just this second, but the next and the next. All the time in the world. Later that morning, Archie did an ecstatic 8 circuits of Swiss Cottage roundabout in his car. His head stuck out the window while a stream of air hit the teeth at the back of his mouth like a windsock. He thought, blimey, so this is what it feels like when some bugger saves your life. Like you've just been handed a great big wad of time. He drove straight past his flat, straight past the street signs, Hendon 3¾, laughing like a loon. At the traffic lights, he flipped 10 pence and smiled when the results seemed to agree that fate was pulling him towards another life, like a dog on a lead round a corner. Generally, women can't do this, but men retain the ancient ability to leave a family and a past. They just unhook themselves, like removing a fake beard and sculpt discreetly back into society. Changed men. Unrecognizable. In this manner, a new Archie is about to emerge. We've caught him on the hop. For he is in a past tense, future perfect kind of mood. He's in a maybe this, maybe that kind of mood. Approaching a forked road, he slows down, checks his undistinguished face in the wing mirror, and quite indiscriminately chooses a route he's never taken before. A residential street leading to a place called Queen's Park. Go straight past, go, Archie boy, he tells himself. Collect 200, and don't for God's sake look back. Tim Wesley, more commonly known as Merlin, finally registered the persistent ringing of a doorbell. He picked himself off the kitchen floor, waded through an ocean of supine bodies, and opened the door to arrive face to face with a middle-aged man dressed head to toe in grey corduroy, holding a 10-pence coin in his open palm. As Merlin was later to reflect when describing the incident, at any time of the day, corduroy is a highly stressful fabric. Rent men wear it, tax men too. History teachers add leather elbow patches. To be confronted with a mass of it at 9 in the AM on the first day of a new year is an apparition lethal in its sheer quantity of negative vibes. What's the deal, man? Merlin blinked in the doorway at the man in corduroy, who stood on his doorstep illuminated by winter sunshine. Encyclopedias or God? Archie noted the kid had an unnerving way of emphasizing certain words by moving his head in a wide circular movement from the right shoulder to the left. Then, when the circle was completed, he would nod several times. 'Cause if it's encyclopedias, we've got enough, like, information, and if it's God, you've got the wrong house. We're in a mellow place here, know what I mean? Merlin concluded, doing the nodding thing and moving to shut the door. Archie shook his head, smiled, and remained where he was. Are you all right? Asked Merlin, hand on the doorknob. Is there something I can do for you? Are you high on something? I saw your sign, said Archie. Merlin pulled on a joint and looked amused. That sign? He bent his head to follow Archie's gaze. The white bedsheet hanging down from an upper window. Across it,
in large rainbow-coloured lettering, was painted, "Welcome to the End of the World Party, 1975. Merlin shrugged.
"Yeah, sorry, man. Looks like it wasn't. Bit of a disappointment, that. Or a blessing," he added amiably. "Depending on your point of view."
"Blessing," said Archie with passion. 100% bona fide blessing."
"Did you, dig the sign then?" asked Merlin, taking a step back behind the doorstep in case the man was violent as well as skits. "You into that kind of scene? It was kind of a joke, you see, more than anything."
"Caught my eye, you might say," said Archie, still beaming like a madman. "I was just driving along looking for somewhere, you know, somewhere to have another drink. New Year's Day, hair of the dog and all that. And I've had a bit of a rough morning all in all, and it just sort of struck me. I flipped a coin and thought, why not?"
Merlin looked perplexed at the turn the conversation was taking. "Party's pretty much over, man. Besides, I think you're a little advanced in years, if you know what I mean."
Here, Merlin turned gauche. Underneath the dashiki, he was at heart a good middle-class boy, instilled with respect for his elders.
"I mean," he said after a difficult pause, "it's a bit of a younger crowd than he might be used to, kind of a commune scene."
"But I was so much older then," sang Archie mischievously, quoting a 10-year-old Dylan track, arching his head round the door.
"I'm younger than that now."
Merlin took a cigarette from behind his ear, lit it, and frowned.
"Look, man, I can't just let anyone in off the street, you know. I mean, you could be the police. You could be a freak. You could..."
But something about Archie's face, huge, innocent, sweetly expectant, reminded Tim what his estranged father, the Vicar of Snarebrook, had to say about Christian charity every Sunday from his pulpit.
"Oh, what the hell, it's New Year's Day, for fuck's sake. You best come in."
Archie sidestepped Merlin and moved into a long hallway with four open-doored rooms branching off from it, a staircase leading to another story, and a garden at the end of it all. Detritus of every variety, animal, mineral, vegetable, lined the floor. A great mass of bedding under which people lay sleeping, stretched from one end of the hallway to the other, a red sea which grudgingly separated each time Archie took a step forward. Inside the rooms, in certain corners, could be witnessed the passing of bodily fluids, kissing, breastfeeding, fucking, throwing up, all the things Archie's Sunday supplement had informed him could be found in a commune. He toyed for a moment with the idea of entering the fray, losing himself between the bodies. He had all this new time on his hands, masses and masses of it, dribbling through his fingers, but decided a stiff drink was preferable. He tackled the hallway until he reached the other end of the house and stepped out into the chilly garden, where some, having given up on finding a space in the warm house, had opted for the cold lawn. With a whiskey tonic in mind, he headed for the picnic table, where something the shape and colour of Jack Daniels had sprung up like a mirage in a desert of empty wine bottles.
"Mind if I..."
Two black guys, a topless Chinese girl and a white woman wearing a toga, were sitting round on wooden kitchen chairs playing rummy. Just as Archie reached for the Jack Daniels, the white woman shook her head and made the signal of a stubbed-out cigarette.
"Tobacco see, I'm afraid, darling. Some evil bastard put his fag out in some perfectly acceptable whiskey. There's baby sham and some other inexorable shit over here."
Archie smiled in gratitude for the warning and the kind offer. He took a seat and poured himself a big glass of Liebfrau milk instead. Many drinks later, and Archie could not remember a time in his life when he had not known Clive and Leo, 1C and Petronia intimately. With his back turned and a piece of charcoal, he could have rendered every puckered goose pimple around 1C's nipples, every stray hair that fell in Petronia's face as she spoke. By 11 a.m, he loved them all dearly. They were the children he had never had. In return, they told him he was in possession of a unique soul for a man of his age. Everybody agreed some intensely positive karmic energy was circulating in and around Archie, the kind of thing strong enough to prompt a butcher to pull down a car window at the critical moment. And it turned out, Archie was the first man over 40 ever invited to join the commune. It turned out there had been talk for some time of the need for an older, sexual presence to satisfy some of the more adventurous women. "Great," said Archie. "Fantastic. That'll be me then."
He felt so close to them that he was confused when around midday their relationship suddenly soured, and he found himself stabbed by a hangover and knee-deep in an argument about the Second World War, of all things. "I don't even know how we got into this," groaned 1C, who had covered up finally just when they decided to move indoors, Archie's corduroy slung around her petite shoulders. "Let's not get into this. I'd rather go to bed than get into this."
"We are into it. We are into it," Clive was ranting. "This is the whole problem with his generation. They think they can hold up the war or some kind of..."
Archie was grateful when Leo interrupted Clive and dragged the argument into some further subset of the original one, which Archie had started. Some unwise remark 3/4 of an hour ago about military service building up a young man's character, and then immediately regretted when it required him to defend himself at regular interludes. Freed finally of this obligation, he sat on the stairs, letting the row continue above while he placed his head in his hands. Shame. He would have liked to have been part of a commune. If he'd played his cards right instead of starting a ding-dong, he might have had free love and bare breasts all over the gaff. Maybe even a portion of allotment for growing fresh food. For a while, around 2 a.m. when he was telling 1C about his childhood, it had looked like his new life was going to be fabulous, and from now on he was always going to say the right thing at the right time, and everywhere he went people would love him. Nobody's fault, thought Archie, mulling over the balls up. Nobody's fault but my own. But he wondered whether there wasn't some higher pattern to it. Maybe there will always be men who say the right thing at the right time, who step forward like Thespis at just the right moment of history, and then there'll be men like Archie Jones, who are just there to make up the numbers, or worse still, who are given their big break only to come in on cue and die a death right there, center stage for all to see. A dark line would now be drawn underneath the whole incident, underneath the whole sorry day, had not something happened that led to the transformation of Archie Jones in every particular that a man can be transformed. And not due to any particular effort on his part, but by means of the entirely random, adventitious collision of one person with another. Something happened by accident. That accident was Clara Bowden. But first, a description. Clara Bowden was beautiful in all senses except maybe by virtue of being black, the classical. Clara Bowden was magnificently tall, black as ebony and crushed sable, with hair plaited in a horseshoe which pointed up when she felt lucky, down when she didn't. At this moment it was up. It is hard to know whether that was significant. She needed no bra. She was independent even of gravity. She wore a red halter neck which stopped below her bust, underneath which she wore her belly button, beautifully, and underneath that some very tight yellow jeans. At the end of it all were some strappy heels of a light brown suede, and she came striding down the stairs on them like some kind of vision, or, as it seemed to Archie as he turned to observe her, like a reared-up thoroughbred. Now, as Archie understood it in movies and the like, it is common for someone to be so striking that when they walk down the stairs, the crowd goes silent. In life, he had never seen it. But it happened with Clara Bowden. She walked down the stairs in slow motion, surrounded by afterglow and fuzzy lighting. And not only was she the most beautiful thing he had ever seen, she was also the most comforting woman he had ever met. Her beauty was not a sharp, cold commodity. She smelt musty, womanly, like a bundle of your favourite clothes. Though she was disorganised physically, legs and arms speaking a slightly different dialect from her central nervous system, even her gangly demeanour seemed to Archie exceptionally elegant. She wore her sexuality with an old woman's ease, and not, as with most of the girls Archie had run with in the past, like an awkward purse, never knowing how to hold it, where to hang it, or when to just put it down. "Cheer up, boy," she said in a Lilton Caribbean accent that reminded Archie of that Jamaican cricketer. "It might never happen." "I think it already has." Archie, who had just dropped a fag from his mouth, which had been burning itself to death anyway, saw Clara quickly tread it underfoot. She gave him a wide grin that revealed possibly her one imperfection, a complete lack of teeth in the top of her mouth.
"Man, they get knocked out," she lisped, seeing his surprise. "But I think to myself, come the end of the world, the lad won't mind if I have no tooths."
She laughed softly. "Archie Jones," said Archie, offering her a Marlboro.
"Clara."
She whistled inadvertently as she smiled and breathed in the smoke.
"Archie Jones, you look just about exactly how I feel. Have Clive and them people been talking foolishness at you? Clive, you been playing with this poor man?"
Clive grunted. The memory of Archie had all but disappeared with the effects of the wine, and continued where he left off, accusing Leo of misunderstanding the difference between political and physical sacrifice. "Oh, no. Nothing serious," Archie burbled, useless in the face of her exquisite face. "Bit of a disagreement, that's all. Clive and I have different views about a few things. Generation gap, I suppose." Clara slapped him on the hand. "Hush him out. You're not that old. I seen older." "I'm old enough," said Archie. And then, just because he felt like telling her, "You won't believe me, but I almost died today." Clara raised an eyebrow.
"You don't say. Well, come and join the club. There are a lot of us about this morning. What a strange party this is." "You know," she said, brushing a long hand across his bald spot, "you look pretty damn good for someone so close to St. Peter's Gate. You want some advice?"
Archie nodded vigorously. He always wanted advice. He was a huge fan of second opinions. That's why he never went anywhere without a 10-pence coin.
"Go home. Get some rest. Morning the world new, every time. Man, this life no easy."
What home? Thought Archie. He had unhooked the old life. He was walking into unknown territory.
"Man," Clara repeated, patting him on the back, "this life no easy."
She let off another long whistle and a rueful laugh. And unless he was really going nuts, Archie saw that come-hither look, identical to Daria's, tinged with a kind of sadness, disappointment, like she didn't have a great deal of other options. Clara was 19. Archibald was 47. 6 weeks later, they were married. 2. Teething Trouble. But Archie did not pluck Clara Bowden from a vacuum, and it's about time people told the truth about beautiful women. They do not shimmer down staircases. They do not descend, as was once supposed, from on high, attached to nothing other than wings. Clara was from somewhere. She had roots. More specifically, she was from Lambeth, via Jamaica, and she was connected through tacit adolescent agreement to one Ryan Topps. Because before Clara was beautiful, she was ugly, and before there was Clara and Archie, there was Clara and Ryan, and there is no getting away from Ryan Topps. Just as a good historian need recognize Hitler's Napoleonic ambitions in the East in order to comprehend his reluctance to invade the British in the West, so Ryan Topps is essential to any understanding of why Clara did what she did. Ryan is indispensable. There was Clara and Ryan for 8 months before Clara and Archie were drawn together from opposite ends of a staircase. And Clara might never have run into the arms of Archie Jones if she hadn't been running quite as fast as she could away from Ryan Topps. Poor Ryan Topps. He was a mass of unfortunate physical characteristics. He was very thin and very tall, red-headed, flat-footed and freckled to such an extent that his skin was rarer than his freckles. Ryan fancied himself as a bit of a mod. He wore ill-fitting grey suits with black polo necks. He wore Chelsea boots after everyone else had stopped wearing them. While the rest of the world discovered the joys of the electronic synthesizer, Ryan swore allegiance to the little men with big guitars, to the Kinks, the Small Faces, the Who. Ryan Topps rode a green Vespa GS scooter, which he polished twice a day with a baby's nappy and kept encased in a custom-built corrugated iron shield. To Ryan's way of thinking, a Vespa was not merely a mode of transport, but an ideology. Family, friend and lover, all rolled into one paragon of late 40s engineering. Ryan Topps, as one might expect, had few friends. Clara Bowden was gangly, buck-toothed, a Jehovah's Witness, and saw in Ryan a kindred spirit. A typical teenage female panopticon, she knew everything there was to know about Ryan Topps long before they ever spoke. She knew the basics, same school, St. Jude's Community School, Lambeth, same height, 6'1". She knew he was, like her, neither Irish nor Roman Catholic, which made them two islands floating surrounded by the Popish Ocean of St. Jude's, enrolled in the school by the accident of their postcodes, reviled by teachers and pupils alike. She knew the name of his bike. She read the tops of his records as they popped up over the brim of his bag. She even knew things about him he didn't know. For example, she knew he was the last man on Earth. Every school has one. and in St. Jude's, as in other seats of learning, it was the girls who chose this moniker and dished it out. There were, of course, variations. Mr. Not for £1 million, Mr. Not to save my mother's life, Mr. Not for world peace. But generally, the schoolgirls of St. Jude's kept to the tried and tested formula. Though Ryan would never be privy to the conversations of the school's female changing rooms, Clara knew. She knew how the object of her affections was discussed. She kept an ear out. She knew what he amounted to when he got down to it, down amongst the sweat and the training bras and the sharp flick of a wet towel.
Ah, Jesus, you're not listening. I'm saying if he was the last man on earth.
I still wouldn't.
Ah, bollocks, you would.
But listen, the whole bleeding world has been hit by the bomb like in Japan, right? And all the good-looking men, all the rise like your man Nicky Laird, they're all dead. They've all been burned to a crisp, and all that's left is Ryan Tops and a bunch of cockroaches.
On me life, I'd rather sleep with the cockroaches.
Ryan's unpopularity at St. Jude's was equaled only by Clara's. On her first day at the school, her mother had explained to her she was about to enter the devil's lair, filled her satchel with 200 copies of The Watchtower, and instructed her to go and do the Lord's work. Week after week she shuffled through the school, head hung to the ground, handing out magazines, murmuring, "Only Jehovah saves." In a school where an overexcited pustule could send you to Coventry, a 6-foot black missionary in knee socks attempting to convert 600 Catholics to the Church of the Jehovah's Witnesses equaled social leprosy. So Ryan was red as a beetroot, and Clara was black as your boot. Ryan's freckles were a join-the-dots enthusiast's wet dream. Clara could circumnavigate an apple with her front teeth before her tongue got anywhere near it. Not even the Catholics would forgive them for it. And Catholics give out forgiveness at about the same rate politicians give out promises and whores give out. Not even St. Jude, who got saddled way back in the first century with the patronage of hopeless causes, due to the tonal similarity between Jude and Judas, was prepared to get involved. At 5 o'clock each day, as Clara sat in her house attending to the message of the Gospels or composing a leaflet condemning the heathen practice of blood transfusion, Ryan Tops would scoot by her open window on his way home. The Bowden living room sat just below street level and had bars on its window, so all views were partial. Generally, she would see feet, wheels, car exhausts, swinging umbrellas. Such slight glimpses were often telling. A lively imagination could squeeze much pathos out of a frayed lace, a darned sock, a low-swinging bag that had seen better days. But nothing affected her more deeply than gazing after the disappearing tailpipe of Ryan's scooter. Lacking any name for the furtive rumblings that appeared in her lower abdomen on these occasions, Clara called it the Spirit of the Lord. She felt that somehow she was going to save the heathen Ryan Tops. Clara meant to gather this boy close to her breast, keep him safe from the temptation that besets us all around, prepare him for the day of his redemption. And wasn't there somewhere lower than her abdomen, somewhere down in the nether region of the unmentionables, was there not the half-conceived hope that Ryan Tops might save her? If Hortense Bowden caught her daughter sitting wistfully by the barred window, listening to the retreating splutter of an engine while the pages of the new Bible flicked over in the breeze, she coofed her upside her head and thanked to remember that only 144,000 of the witnesses of Jehovah would sit in the court of the Lord on Judgment Day, amongst which number of the anointed, there was no space for nasty-looking so-and-sos on motorcycles.
"But what if we save some people," Hortense asserted with a snort, "have done such a whole heap of sinning, it late for them to be making eyes at Jehovah. It take effort to be close to Jehovah. It take devotion and dedication. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they alone shall see God." Matthew 5:8. Isn't that right, Darkus?
Darkus Bowden, Clara's father, was an odoriferous, moribund, salivating old man entombed in a bug-infested armchair from which he had never been seen to remove himself, not even, thanks to a catheter, to visit the outdoor toilet. Darkus had come over to England 14 years earlier and spent the whole of that period in the far corner of the living room watching television. The original intention had been that he should come to England and earn enough money to enable Clara and Hortense to come over, join him, and settle down. However, on arrival, a mysterious illness had debilitated Darkus Bowden, an illness that no doctor could find any physical symptoms of, but which manifested itself in the most incredible lethargy. Creating in Darkus, admittedly never the most vibrant of men, a lifelong affection for the dole, the armchair, and British television. In 1972, enraged by a 14-year wait, Hortense decided finally to make the journey on her own steam. Steam was something Hortense had in abundance. She arrived on the doorstep with the 17-year-old Clara, broke down the door in a fury, and, so the legend went back in St. Elizabeth, gave Darkus Bowden the tongue-whipping of his life. Some say this onslaught lasted 4 hours. Some say she quoted every book of the Bible by memory, and it took a whole day and a whole night. What is certain is, at the end of it all, Darkus slumped deeper into the recesses of his chair, looked mournfully at the television with whom he had had such an understanding, compassionate relationship, so uncomplicated, so much innocent affection, and a tear squeezed its way out of its duct and settled in a crag underneath his eye. Then he said just one word. Hmm. Hmm, was all Darkus said or ever was to say after. Ask Darkus anything, query him on any subject at any hour of the day and night, interrogate him, chat with him, implore him, declare your love for him, accuse him or vindicate him, and he will give you only one answer. I say, isn't that right, Darkus? Hmm. And it not, exclaimed Hortense, returning to Clara, having received Darkus's grunt of approval. That young man's soul you bothering yourself with. How many times must I tell you? You got no time for boys. For time was running out in the Bowden household. This was 1974. And Hortense was preparing for the end of the world, which in the house diary she had marked carefully in blue biro, 1 January 1975. This was not a solitary psychosis of the Bowdens. There were 8 million Jehovah's Witnesses waiting with her. Hortense was in large, albeit eccentric, company. A personal letter had come to Hortense, as secretary of the Lambeth branch of the Kingdom Halls, with a photocopied signature from William J. Rangeforth, of the largest kingdom hall in the USA, Brooklyn, confirming the date. The end of the world had been officially confirmed with a gold-plated letterhead, and Hortense had risen to the occasion by setting it in an attractive mahogany frame. She had given it pride of place on a doily on top of the television, between a glass figurine of Cinderella on her way to the ball and a tea cozy embroidered with the Ten Commandments. She had asked Darkus whether he thought it looked nice. He had humphed his assent. The end of the world was nigh, and this was not, the Lambeth branch of the Church of the Jehovah's Witnesses was to be assured, like the mistakes of 1914 and 1925. They had been promised the entrails of sinners wrapped around the trunks of trees, and this time the entrails of sinners wrapped around the trunks of trees would appear. They had waited so long for the rivers of blood to overflow the gutters in the high streets, and now their thirst would be satiated. The time had come. This was the right date. This was the only date. All other dates that might have been proffered in the past were the result of some bad calculations. Someone forgot to add. Someone forgot to minus. Someone forgot to carry the one. But now was the time. The real thing. 1 January 1975. Hortense, for one, was glad to hear it. The first morning of 1925, she had wept like a baby when she awoke to find, instead of hail and brimstone and universal destruction, the continuance of daily life, the regular running of the buses and trains. It had been for nothing then, all that tossing and turning the previous night, waiting for those neighbours, those who failed to listen to your warnings, to sink under a hot and terrible fire that shall separate their skin from their bones, shall melt the eyes in their sockets and burn the babies that suckle at their mother's breasts. So many of your neighbours shall die that day that their bodies, if lined up side by side, will stretch 300 times round the earth, and on their charred remains shall the true witnesses of the Lord walk to his side. The Clarion Bell, issue 245. How bitterly she had been disappointed. But the wounds of 1925 had healed, and Hortense was once again ready to be convinced that apocalypse, just as the right holy Mr. Rangeforth had explained, was round the corner. The promise of the 1914 generation still stood. This generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled, Matthew 24:34. Those who were alive in 1914 would live to see the Armageddon. It had been promised. Born in 1907, Hortense was getting old now. She was getting tired, and her